Okay, good afternoon, and welcome to Agudas Yisrael's legal and compliance webinar titled The Law of the Land is Law, Harry H. Barron, Dina de Malchus, the Dina Series. I'm Rabbi Shai Markowitz, the Director of the Lefkowitz Leadership Initiative here at the Agudah. Today's session is number two of an overall series and is titled Hot Topics in Proper Wage and Hourly Compliance. It's going to be an informative review and update on the various laws regulating minimum wage and overtime issues. Some of the points will be the executive, professional, administrative, overtime exemptions, when overtime is not or is required under law, basic employer compliance, penalties you could face, and a religious institution's possible exemption. As part of the Law of the Land is Law, Harry H. Barron, Dina de Malchus Dina series, we are planning a few more webinars before the end of June. We have already scheduled one on pointers and pitfalls for nonprofit leaders on money laundering and criminal tax law for June 7th, which you'll be able to join via webinar or in person at our offices. We're also planning a follow-up session on QTR, parsonage, and more. Please keep an eye in your inbox for upcoming webinars so we can best serve you. And please take a few minutes to let us have your feedback after by sending me an email. My relationship with David Kramer goes back many years to his days as administrator in YTT in Staten Island. He has been an administrator for more than 25 years and for the past 11 years has been at Yeshiva of South Shore. He also gives classes for Torah Masor's Academy of Leadership Fundraising. Most importantly, he's always available to help with any of the questions I or other administrators have had. Before I pass over the mic to Rabbi Kramer, just some technical issues and instructions. We will hopefully have questions and answer opportunity after the presentation. On your screen, perhaps in the top right, there's a Q&A button which allows you to submit questions to the panelists. There's also an option for chat, which goes also to the panelists, and Rabbi Kramer and myself will monitor that. On the top of your screen, also perhaps on the left or another place, you can change the view, sometimes to see the speaker, to see the gallery, to see the screen that John has. Thank you very much, and Rabbi Kramer, the floor is all yours.
Shalom Aleichem, everyone. Shai, thank you so much for inviting me. When Shai called me, asking if I knew anyone who could give this type of a labor law presentation, the obvious choice was John Farrell. He's a parent in the yeshiva. He was actually an honoree at our dinner, a very successful one. He is top in his field. He's what we would call a shark. He's just driven to make sure that his client gets what they need. He's a partner at Meltzer Lippi. You could read his bio online, how he practices before the National Labor Relations Board. He litigates in all areas regarding labor and employment laws, OSHA, EEOC, ADA, FMLA. He's a New York super lawyer. We actually had him make a presentation for Five Towns Executive Directors, which was very successful, and people want to hear him again. I think you will all gain from hearing what he has to say. He's helped many, many yeshivas with overtime issues, with issues of unionizing issues. He actually helped our yeshiva. Obviously, I consult with him. He helped us just recommending a top lawyer, which did a good job for us. He's always makes himself available, and he's a wonderful fellow. So without further ado, I will pass over the mic to John. Thanks.
Thank you, Shai. Thank you, Rabbi Kramer. And thank you for running a great school. My children have loved attending, and one is graduating. The last one, Baruch Hashem, is graduating in a month. Okay, so I'm here to speak about wage hour law. Thank you, all the attendees. This is my first webinar. I guess I'm an old man. I usually speak with people in front of me, but I'm speaking and people are listening. This normally is a half-day subject, 4 hours, 5 hours. If you have any questions, which I'm sure a lot of people will, I understand there's a chat box or something electronic. I also happen to have something old that's called a landline. You could call me on the number below. You could also use email. That's fine. I'm here to talk for an hour about wage and hour law. And wage and hour law affects everybody. I have done hundreds of cases. That I think it's over 1,000 wage and hour cases, and hundreds in the Orthodox community. I have represented two yeshivas on wage and hour cases. Very, very expensive wage and hour cases. These were large yeshivas, and they thought they were exempt from wage and hour law. They were not. So, and of course, numerous businesses. It's funny. There is just today, if you go, this a service called Pacer, and you could type in Pacer Eastern District But there's a kosher supermarket suit for overtime today, and it's online. It's not my client. I won't identify it. But the reason I know is I follow the cases that are filed. So this is a hot topic in law. It's no longer have you been injured. It's no longer was there a slip and fall. It's if you listen to the Spanish, if you listen to the radio station, if you read the Spanish newspapers, it's have you been paid overtime? Have you been paid all hours worked? And even if you think you're doing it right and it comes from a place of goodness, it is a possibility you're doing it wrong. So this is going to be a very brief seminar. You're welcome to review the materials afterward. And as I said, please call me if you have any questions. So if you could, again, so we're going to quickly talk about the exemptions, when it's required, basic employer compliance. You have 50, 60 pages. I only have another less about 55 minutes, so we'll go quickly. Second, turn the page. So the first page, part one, there's various laws. There's the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. That's the federal overtime law. And there's the New York State wage and hour law. If you're out of state, each state has its own mini labor law, even conservative states like Louisiana and Texas, right? You wouldn't think more New Hampshire, the live free or die state. So all states are covered. You're covered by a federal statute and a state statute. Basically, those statutes require payment of overtime if you're non-exempt. So what's the overtime? Overtime, if you can go to that, there's a chart. This is New York City. This is New York State, excuse me, the chart you're looking at that Tony did. Thank you, Tony. By the way, I have my the head of our marketing. I want to say thank you, Tony DeSaur. She is unbelievable. And I am, like I said, an old man and she's a young woman. And she put all this together. But if you could look at the chart, New York City large business, New York City small business, Nassau, Suffolk, rest of state, TBD is to be determined. So right now we have $11. And it's funny, if you look, it's December 31st, but January 1st, basically, it goes up to 13 in New York City, 15. So you have to pay overtime and you have to pay minimum wage, right? You have to pay overtime. So there's a question, what happens if I pay the person on a salary? Can that include all hours worked, right? So this concerns an hourly wage. But let's assume a lot of my cases, the one I did for Yeshiva, involving hundreds and hundreds of people, and what they did is they paid maintenance people, kitchen staff, custodial staff, a flat rate. And they paid a very good flat rate. Their belief was we're paying a flat rate. And let's assume the minimum wage at that period of time was $8 an hour. They were working, so 8 times 40 would be 320. Let's say they were paying $550 a week. They believe that included all the overtime. How many times have I heard cases which have unfortunately made the firm, which has fortunately made the firm a lot of money, I thought it included the overtime, or I built in the overtime. Excuse me, you might hear children outside. School is letting out. So you have to pay people who are entitled to overtime an hourly wage rate. You can reverse engineer that number. If you know somebody wants to take home an X amount, you can figure out what that amount should be on an hourly rate for the first 40 hours. Let's assume, forget about the $11 an hour. Let's assume minimum wage was $10. Someone wants to make $10 an hour for the first 40, $15 an hour for the second 10, works 50 hours. He says, I want to make $5.50. You know he has to make $10 an hour. So the fact that you pay somebody a salary doesn't mean they're not entitled to overtime. So right now we have an hourly rate, and that's the hourly rate. Note that it goes up each year. That's very important. You could turn the page. Now we're going into a little bit of the substance. Both laws require the payment of overtime at the 1.5 times the regular rate. That's what I was talking just before. How do you determine that? If somebody works on a salary and he's non-exempt, he's entitled to overtime. Doesn't matter how much you pay him. You can have a janitor pushing a broom. You can pay him $40,000 a week, right? That is the world's greatest janitor. He is the gold Olympic janitor. Nobody pushes a broom like this janitor. He's entitled to overtime. You could say, I'm paying you $1,000. No, question is how do you determine that? If he works 50, it's funny, his overtime rate is determined, fluctuates. It's very difficult because you would divide, let's assume he worked 50 hours, it's 50 into 40,000 and then 16 to 40,000 if he worked 60, because the regular rate changes every week depending on the hours worked. That's the definitive term, the regular rate. It's much easier if somebody's non-exempt, which is most people, right, to pay them an hourly rate. Offline, if somebody wants to truly pay somebody a salary for reasons which is probably just to make me a lot of money, if somebody wants to pay somebody a salary, this, and for somebody who's still entitled to overtime, there is a way to do it, but still they're entitled to overtime. Now, before we begin, this is later on in the materials. I lectured before the executive directors of five towns. When I lecture to religious organizations, they're like, well, we're a religious organization, we're exempt. There is a ministerial exemption, as we know, it went to the Supreme Court, and it also has been applied to wage and hour laws. The question is, who's covered under the ministerial exemption? The case before the Supreme Court in 2016, interestingly enough, concerned the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church, by its own definition, only has male priests. So the executive assistant to the Catholic priest was having a child out of wedlock. And she was pregnant, and she was fired. And the whole court, the unanimous court, ruled that, so she brought a suit, said, I cannot be covered by the ministerial exemption because, as a matter of law, a Catholic priest has to be a male. I'm pregnant. I'm a female, I can't be covered, therefore the ministerial exemption shouldn't apply. Court ruled unanimously, all the liberals with all the conservatives, or interestingly, the ministerial exemption is not that narrowly drawn. It's the minister and anyone who acts in place of the minister. Obviously, the executive secretary, Rabbi Kramer, who is Rabbi Kamenetsky, that secretary was acting as in lieu of the priest when the priest wasn't available. And so the court ruled she was covered by the ministerial exemption. You have to spread the faith. These are some of the factors. Has to be involved in, forgive me, the courts use the word church governments, obviously shul governments, supervision of a religious order, supervision of participation in religion, ritual, and workshops. You have to involve yourself in, if I can use the vernacular, the spreading of the faith, the religious nature of the institution. Cleaning up a student's vomit at the ending of the day does not make you a minister. It makes you a janitor. So I can tell you, I've had yeshivas, I said the several that I've represented, and I'm not even referring to the union issues and the discrimination issues. Most of the employees of the nonprofit, even if it has a secular nature, will not be covered by the ministerial exemption. The purpose of these laws is to effectuate coverage. The purpose of these laws is to cover individuals. The purpose of these laws is to afford protection to the populace. It's not to allow people to fall under exemption. So I hear this all the time, and I said, you're right. There is a ministerial exemption. I've used it. I used it actually once very successfully for an individual up in Muncie. And an institution in Muncie. So it does exist, but it's very narrowly tailored. One final thing, by the way, for the religious schools out there, anybody can be a plaintiff. And that's why it's so important. I've done numerous cases for, unfortunately, religious Jews not resorting to the baked-in system who file suit. It's important to comply, not only for non-Jewish, but because it's just the law and it protects the institution. And of course, there's no ministerial exemption for a profit-making enterprise or an enterprise that may be a nonprofit that obviously doesn't concern the spread of the ministry, such as the Boys Club of America. Okay, so if you were on the same page, there's 1.5 times, right? There's two laws, FOSA. You basically get 3 years for willful violations. New York State, they can go back 6 years. Look at G. G is very important. On the FLSA, prevailing plaintiff is entitled to liquidated damages, interest, and attorney's fees. So I tell clients, whatever money you think you are saving, you're not. For every dollar you save, you're going to pay a dollar back. That's a dollar. Plus interest at approximately 20% a year. Yes, the mafia should charge such interest, which compounds yearly. It's hard to know if these jokes are working, but Tony just laughed. The mafia should be so lucky to get this interest rate and attorney's fees. So I tell individuals, for every dollar you think you save, it's going to be approximately $1.50 to $2 penalties, interest, fees, and there's personal liability, right? So there's automatic personal liability and payroll cases and wage and hour cases. For anybody involved in not only the ownership but the supervision of the employee, we have significant penalties. You have to pay overtime. We've already discussed what the hourly rates are. You have to pay overtime. ministerial exemption probably doesn't apply. Turn the page, right? U.S. Department of Labor conducts audits, the U.S. DOL, right? They are professionals. New York State DOL, not so much. They come knocking on your door. They have an office now. When I was young and no gray hair, I've been told I had no gray hair by my children. There wasn't even an office of the U.S. DOL in Brooklyn. There were so many cases they actually had to open, a federal government had to open a fully staffed office in downtown Brooklyn for all the cases. It's always horrible when the DOL and their federal agents knock on your door. Full disclosure, don't, when the DOL comes, my advice is you do not have to answer them. You can say, I'd like to get my attorney. It is a felony to lie to a federal government agent, even without oath. Martha Stewart, as we know, Martha Stewart was so smart. They came to her. They sat across from her. She was not under oath, and she went to jail. Louis Libby, who was the counselor for or a senior advisor for George Bush, lied. He was not under oath. It is a felony under the federal, on the United States Code, to lie to an officer of the federal government. It is not considered perjury since you're not under oath. It is obstruction of justice. So when someone knocks on your door, and I've had people say, how many hours are they working? Well, they never work overtime. They're writing all this down, right? In their notes, these people are trained to take notes. Whatever we feel about President Trump, right? They want Comey's notes because they know, rightfully or wrongfully, they are an accurate description of what happened in his meetings. So I tell people, just say you'd like to see an attorney. I'd rather not talk about it. It is obstruction of justice, and there is a possibility of turning a civil action into a criminal one. New York State DOL, that's only a misdemeanor, and they're not, they have the right to come onto the premises. They will not be, there's something called the Wage Theft Prevention Act. It's an act passed under Governor Patterson. Who would ever think a man who was only governor for less than 2 years could do so much damage? But that being said, they have the right to come in unannounced. And again, you have the right to say, I'd rather not speak to you. I'd like to get my attorney, whoever that attorney is. All right, there are posters you may have under L and K, right? So you want to get those posters. We can skip the enterprise coverage, individual coverage. Under the FLSA, which records are recovered? You need a pay stub. There's the New York State Wage Theft Prevention Act notice, and there is the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. You have to have certain information. You have to keep information on your pay stub. Okay, the pay stub, theoretically, most employees have to be paid once a week. I say theoretically. I guess that could be honored in the breach. Here is the problem. If you're paying employees, the stub has to, each work week stands alone. So I've done dozens of cases where the person, the individual, shows 80 hours a week, and you know, Monday through Friday, Monday through Sunday, and then the following Monday through Sunday. That's a 14-day period. Each work week is a 7-day period. Overtime is owed after 40 hours a week worked, and we can discuss what worked is. That's not really the subject of this conversation, but as a side note, if you could tell me in a second, remind that. Mm-hmm. Your pay stub, so if it's a 2-week period and it shows 83 hours, and then you show 80, let's assume you show 63 hours worked. The DOL, no one is going to know how many hours that person worked each week. They get overtime after 40 hours. So did it show 65 hours? Did they work 45 and 20? Did they work 30 and 30? So, and that's a fine. Under New York State, under the FLSA, it's not monetary, but if you, under the Wage Theft Prevention Act, it's $100 per employee up to, I believe, $2,500 a year each year. So if you have 100 employees, you know, we've done Fair Labor Standards, we've done Wage Theft Prevention Act cases where the demands are hundreds of thousands of dollars because the wage notice are incorrect. You have to have the name of the employer. You have to have the address. You have to have the wage rate. You have to have the overtime rate. You have to have the hours worked and the overtime hours. If you don't do it, it is a fine. It's called the Wage Theft Prevention Act. Now, what is hours worked? As a side note, and I have a memo to, if anybody is interested in a lot of this, then as I said, this could be a 4 or 5 hour lecture. It's hours worked. Any break of less than 20 minutes is considered hours worked. So paid holidays, not considered hours worked. So Monday, somebody has off, and Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, he works 4 tens. Joe, you got to work 4 tens. You're working Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Monday, they have off. It's paid holiday. It's Memorial Day. You pay for Memorial Day. Right? So you want to, interestingly, he comes in, he says, you know, I got paid for 48 hours. How come I didn't get overtime? Because under the Fair Labor Standards Act, which has been adopted by New York State, other states may be different. For instance, California has daily overtime, but New York and Fair Labor Standards Act, it's 40 hours a week worked. Joe, you didn't work on Monday, but I got paid for it, but you didn't work. For instance, I'm being nice, Joe. I'm paying you for the holiday, but I'm not going to pay you for the overtime. For instance, I believe like my firm, you would get a paid holiday, but overtime you'd have to have actually 48 hours of pay. So it's, by the way, it's important because I've done those cases. Actually, I've done those cases for a large client in Cedarhurst where he was paying for all the Jewish holidays, but he showed it as hours worked, but he didn't pay overtime. So under your wage notice, under your pay stub, it should say pay time off, right? PTO, pay time off. Now, what is considered hours worked? Any break more than 20 minutes. And the reason is this. The federal government assumes that a break less than 20 minutes is for the benefit of the employer. Man has to go to I'm not a misogynist, but I'm always going to say man. A man has to go to use a men's room, ladies room, to take 10 minutes off so they don't cut their hand off on the machine press. That's for the benefit of the employer, right? So he doesn't have the hands separated from the worker. That's a 10-minute break to go to the men's room. Somebody takes 40 minutes off to take a smoking break, go take 30 minutes off for lunch. That's for the benefit of the employee. So any break more than 20 minutes is not considered hours worked. Obviously, 8 hours paid Memorial Day is more than 20 minutes. That's why it's so important, by the way, even my firm, you hear saying those that can do, those that can't teach, those that can't teach, teach teachers, right? But even our firm, we require all employees to sign in and out. Do you sign in and out? You're exempt. So, but all my legal assistant, Ann Dilla, who Rabbi Kramer has known for 20 years, signs in and out. Actually, we now have a punch system. So you can, the next page, it shows what you have to have. Okay. New York requires similar records, plus the employee must maintain the number of hours worked daily and weekly, the time of arrival of departures exceeding 10 hours. There's a form, and I urge all employers who know of this, congratulations, it's called the Wage Theft Prevention Act notice. Failure to have its $5,000 fine, I guess, but it's brought by private litigants. You have to give it to all new employees. It used to be every year you had to give it, and so if you didn't give it once, I mean, it's funny, again, how much damage could Governor Patterson really do in 18 months? So you had to give this, and it was $5,000 every year. What other governmental form do you give out every year? Not the I-9s, not the tax forms, but this had to be given out every year. It was actually changed. It has to be accurate. And you have to give it out when you decrease an individual salary or hourly wage. Excuse me. You do not have to you do not have to provide it to the employees when you raise their wage rate. But it's called the Wage Theft Prevention Act form. There is approximately 15 different forms. Hourly employee, exempt employee, hourly and exempt employee, employees who work on government jobs, employees who are paid on commission, employees who are paid on commission and a salary. It's literally like you can mix and match. And literally there's at least 10, probably 15. Of government forms, and it's called the Wage Theft Prevention Act Notice. If you're on the computer, you can Google it after, New York State Department of Labor, Wage Theft Prevention Act Notice. You have to give it in the language that the employee understands, and which is the primary language. There are forms for approximately 7 or 8 different languages now in New York State, and other states have similar forms. New York State has New York, Spanish, Russian, Chinese, Korean, Polish, Haitian Creole, various languages. And every year they come out with another language. So that has to be given to the employees, Wage Theft Prevention Act notice. Please do it. It's included in every complaint that I see. Okay, how long do you save the records? Next slide. Under the FLSA, you have to save it 3 years. Under the state, you like to save it 6 years. I tell employers, save them for 10. And the reason is because it's the year 2000. I had a case where the complaint sat in the DOL for 3 years. So when they asked for records, they asked for 6 years back. So they asked for 9 years. And I remember the client saying to me, I just threw out all the records a year ago. My old attorney said, I just had to save them for 6 years. I'm like, yeah, your attorney, they say wisdom is knowledge and experience. He had the knowledge, he didn't have the experience. It may sit at the DOL for a year or two. So when they come back, they'll say 6 years back from the time of the filing. Filing may be 2 years old. Records can be scanned in. I used to tell clients the cost for storage in Suffolk County. Suffolk County is a rural county on eastern Long Island, for those not in New York State. It becomes quite rural with cows, chickens, and God knows what. I would tell people it's $4 to $5 a square foot for a year. You get a small 8x8 storage locker. Now no one stores anything. Scan records are just as fine. So scan in the records. I told people once they're scanning, you don't even have to worry about saving them. You save them forever. And by the way, time records, it's so important that people punch in and out, sign in and out, have some sort of record keeping mechanism. Okay, how long? 6 years, as we said. Next page, thank you. But you really want to do 10. Compensable time, right? Next page, right? 725. 1.5 times, we've gone through this, right? 11 large businesses, right? 11 is for a large business. You have that nice chart, which actually comes from the DOL website. New York State DOL, I'm loath to admit it, pay the government a compliment. But the New York State Department of Labor website is extremely well done, and to the extent that any governmental website can be user-friendly, and yes, I'm not choking as I say that, but to the extent that any government website can be user-friendly, I urge businesses and nonprofits to actually review the business section. They have nice charts, FAQs, questions. And some of them are so good. Sometimes clients, not sometimes, a lot, when clients call me and ask me the questions, I direct them to the DOL website. And I say, I want you to read their FAQs. And they'll say, why? I said, because for the first hour, I'm going to charge you in explaining the law. Or the first 2 hours, I'm going to charge you and explain you the law. Why don't you review it on your own leisure, save yourself some money, and then come on and we'll have a much more productive conversation. And they're appreciative of my cost conscious and their ability to actually save money. A 7 consecutive 24-hour periods, each work week stands alone. Okay, hours worked. It's suffered or permitted for work. That means if you're in a slow period and they come into work, they have to get paid. That means somebody's eating lunch at their desk. No, my secretary eats lunch at my secretary and legal assistant eats at her desk, and she makes me buy her the lunch half the time. But that being said, she gets paid for that, right? Hours worked. As long as they're on the clock, they get paid. If they're not on the clock, they don't get paid. That's why it's so important for them to punch in and out, or swipe in and out, or palm in and out. It's that simple. You know, people come in and they tell me, I've had many, many cases. Well, she comes in early and she punches in because she drops off her kid. You can hear the diction in my voice. You know, what can I do? She drops off her kids and then she's here for an hour. And so you discipline her. And Rabbi Kramer, that was one of the things we did for the executive directors, was discipline. It's your shop. You tell the employee they can't come in before, they can't punch in. You will be personally liable. You will be personally liable for the unpaid overtime. So no, Joe, you can't come in. I understand that you drive your wife to the train station and then you have an hour and a half, nothing to do. And he's just hanging out here. No, you can't hang out here because this is not a bar. This is not a romper room. We're here to work. So you can't come in early. Similarly, I've had so many cases. Well, you know, I gave him, he couldn't get the job done within 8 hours. He was just too slow. He had to stay late. I said, okay. By the way, in the union world, that's called a workload grievance, right? The man is cleaning 10 bathrooms, and then you give him 30 to clean, and then you discipline him for not cleaning 30. And then you say, well, I fired him because he couldn't do the job. That's called a workload grievance. Well, of course he couldn't do the job. He went from half the bathrooms to, you know, 10 to 30. But the point to that is, if someone needs more time to do the job, they're either two things. They're either three things. One, they've been given an unrealistic deadline. Two, they're stupid. Or three, they're incompetent. The fact is, if someone, Joe, I need to do this within 8 hours. And guy says, I need 10. The answer isn't, well, you know, I'm only going to pay you for 8. The answer is, that's fine. You know, it really should be done in 8, and you're fired. And it's funny, one of my cases I did at the NLRB for someone in Cedarhurst, who was the union official, and this is the government in action. And what happened is, it took him like 8 hours to change a door. And I could change a door with my son by taking the hinges off in about 20 minutes. We actually fired him. The union didn't even grieve it, but somehow the government thought he was fired for union activity, and we won. But you're allowed to fire people. We won the trial, and the union wasn't even a party to the trial, which usually they would be. But the point of that story is if somebody's doing work for you, good, bad, or indifferent, they have to get paid. Waiting time, you can read that. Basically, if they're waiting for work, the minute they walk through that door and punch in and out, they deserve to get paid. Two stories. When I was young, I worked for Northville Gas Station. You know, I worked three jobs. My father was unemployed. And I remember we clocked off at 12 o'clock. I had a Belshuva, so this is real a great story. From 4 to 12. I worked from 4 to 12, Saturday, 2 through 12. So Saturday, I would get in at 2 p.m. I'd work to 12. 12 o'clock, we'd close down. Of course, then telling me I'm an old man, so it's 12 o'clock. Interestingly, I was robbed twice at gunpoint. But that being said, so it's 12 o'clock. I then have to take my stick readings. I then have to count all the money that I haven't already counted. I have to put it in a drop safe. It took 45 minutes. I was a good employee. I was a good employee, so good he knew I wouldn't, this is before the incident, I would work until 12 o'clock at night and then do my job, as opposed to the guy before me who would do drugs in the back of the room at 10 o'clock at night. I'm being absolutely serious. I was a good employee. One day I get a call from the Department of Labor. They ask me, how long did I stay? This is 1982. I tell them I stayed until 12:30, 1 o'clock. They say, how often? I tell them. I didn't want to speak to them. I was a good employee. I was the assistant manager. 35 years ago, I remember getting a check for $4,000 because I was working and he worked till 12. That's when he thought I should get paid to. And it was Northville. If you remember, to the ones in New York, they actually became BP stations. It was gas stations. That story is indicative, and I love telling it because I hated speaking to the DOL. But it was a government official and the person said, you got to speak to me, and which wasn't true, but I was 18 years old. And two, I just told him the truth. I didn't even tell him about I had to cover my own shortages. So that's the story about hours worked. If somebody needs more time to do the job, there's two options. You either give him more time, you being the employer, or you discipline and terminate. Of course, you understand in my situation, going back a lifetime ago, there was no way on God's green earth I could ever do the job within the required time. I was required to work till 12, and at 12:01, I had to punch out. And then the real work began. So that's an interesting story. On call time, you can read about being, there's questions about being on call and not being on call. There's very detailed regulations. Superintendents, you usually have to pay for it. However, if you live in the place where you're a superintendent, if that doesn't mean you have to be paid under federal law, state law, you usually have to pay for on-call time. Yet again, there's an exemption if you live in the place that you work. Rest and meal periods. The law has detailed requirements for unpaid meal breaks in New York State. I ignore all of them. I work with my secretary. She comes in at 8 sometimes and work till 8 o'clock at night. She says I'm a slave driver. That's why she eats at her desk. So it's great. This law exists. You can ignore it. Lectures, meeting, travel time. Basic rule of travel time. Basically, the basic rule of travel time, and I'm sorry to be so quick, but I understand I'm already only have 25 minutes left. The basic rule of travel time is the fact that if they go from one place to another, if they go, let's say, if they travel to Rabbi Kamensky's yeshiva, South Shore, and then he has them go to a location, they're on the clock. Interestingly, for those who ever commute into the city, you will see a tremendous amount of people driving their vans, service vans, at 7 o'clock into the city, because the employers, this is for maintenance work, because the employers don't want them to come to the shop. The shops are usually out on Long Island, and you're paying a lot of money for to travel an hour and a half each way. So a lot of employers, particularly in maintenance and construction, will say go directly to the job site. If someone is traveling during the day from site to site, and they're for one of your institutions, they're traveling in between, and the travel time can take up 70% of the day. If you're ever on the Cross Bronx or the BQE, they got to get paid. They get paid from the time they get to the location to the time they are done. Go on in travel time. Employee independent contractors. Okay, keep up. I have a whole nice 15-page memo on independent contractors. Most employ people who you believe are independent contractors are not independent contractors, and I've done significant litigation. And the fact that, and when I lecture, I say when 1982, when 1982, I had three jobs after high school. Worked at a Roy Rogers, worked at a Northville, and worked at a wash and dry. I said, that didn't mean I was an independent contractor. It just meant I was poor. And that's very important, because the fact that someone comes and goes and has multiple jobs doesn't make them an independent contractor. That's number one. The fact that someone comes and goes at their leisure. For instance, my secretary, legal assistant, can come and go. She sets her own hours unless I need her. She comes in when her starting hours are her own. She leaves when I tell her I'm done for the day. That doesn't make her an independent contractor. I've done so many cases on this classification. The basic rule of someone's independent contractor for the Department of Labor and the courts is risk of loss and control. Risk of loss is I have in my house, I tell a contractor I need them to build a wing. They have $200,000 and they're not going to get a penny more. He has risk of loss. If there's problems and the delays, he has risk of loss. Risk of loss is, and I've had people, and they're independent contractors. Why are they independent? Where's the risk of loss? Well, if they don't work, they don't get paid, right? I pay them $40 an hour. They come and go as they please. And if they don't work, they don't get paid. I say that's every employee. There's no risk of loss. At the worst, they can only be zero. But that's any employee once you exhaust paid leave. If most employees don't come in, they don't get paid. There's no risk of loss. So when I lecture on independent contractor, there's significant problems with misclassification. Not only will you owe the overtime, because people misclassify so they don't keep track of the hours, under workers' comp, you're not paying premiums, which is $2,000 a day for every 10 days forever. So you're looking at fines when you do workers' compensation, and you can ask your insurance brokers, they'll tell you. You easily, when you have people who get injured and they say, I wasn't an independent contractor, not only do you get hit with a penalty, you also have to pay for the underlying claim itself. So we're talking about the exemptions now, and this is the last 20 minutes. So who's exempt? If you can go to the chart, that's fine. There's three main exemptions. There's dozens, but I won't deal with the small town rural newspaper exemption or the Carney Barker exemption. The main exemptions, first of all, we would call the administrative, the executive, and the professional, and we'll get to that. There's two requirements for the exemption. The first one is how you are paid, and the second one is what do you do? It's called the salary basis test and the duties test. Obviously, you have already discussed a janitor who's pushing a broom making $40,000 a week meets the salary test, which we'll get in a minute, but he's not exempt, right? He doesn't meet the duties test. So it's interesting. Under federal law, you can ask your accountants, and it is $455 a week. You have to be paid that in a salary. And salaries can't be docked. You can't dock half days. And in most instances, you can't dock a full day. And I have a memo on that. So they get that. What does the salary mean? If somebody works 1 hour that week, or for a true exempt employee like a professional accountant making $2,000 a week, you run an accounting firm, Mary, you make $2,000 a week if you work 30 hours a week or if you work 60, right? Tax season, I need you to work 60 hours a week. You're coming in Mochi Shabbos. Tony, that's after Shabbos. You're coming in Mochi Shabbos. You're working on Sunday. You're working almost up to candle lighting. Doesn't matter how many hours a week, you get the same salary. It's funny, when I see people who are incorrectly exempt, they're docked. They're docked. They get the same salary when they work 50, 60 hours a week. But when they work 30 hours a week, they don't so much get the same salary. It's interesting how that works out. Rarely works out for the benefit of the employee. It also destroys the salary basis. That's number one. So it's 455 under the state law, under federal law. The state has a much higher exemption. So I remember a case last week. It was an attorney. He says, we're speaking to the client, and it was horrible. He says, they're exempt because of they meet the duties test, which they didn't, by the way. And he says, they meet the salary test because not only are they paid $455 an hour, they're paid at least $600 a week. He said, that's great, but we happen to live in New York. So on this chart, here's the salary basis, right? Here's the salary basis. You have to pay, so people, and it wasn't always this high, but it was before they raised the minimum wage, it was $650 in New York State, and this doesn't apply to This applies to administrative and executive. I don't believe it applies to professional. But anyway, it's 825. So if you have an administrative employee and you believe he's exempt, your accountant or your professional may say, well, salary basis is 455. Under state law, as of in 2 years, he's going to have to be making almost $55,000 a year or be entitled to overtime. Right? And that only goes up. So right here, you can turn the page. You can see it's $455 a week. Ignore that. It's great that it's in here, but under the state, it's what governs in New York State. And for those who are out of state, New York State actually is one of the more conservative states when it comes to passing these laws because our taxes are so high. And the politicians informally have taken the position that we won't pass these ridiculous laws because we know it's so expensive. Excuse me. So you have to pay a salary. We can all do the math. $825 right now, it's $40,000 a year. Executive. So we're going to discuss the executive administrator. Most people know who executives are. There's not that many of them in a company. Has to primary have the primary duty of managing the enterprise, right? And you have to supervise two or more full-time employees, have the authority to hire, fire, change status. You have to manage part of the enterprise. So at my prior firm, I was not chair of the labor group many, many years ago, at least 10 years ago. So I was a professional because I was an attorney and I had three or four associates under me, but I had the co-chair. There was the chair. So I wasn't an executive. You can be more than one, right? So an executive has to manage the enterprise or recognized departments, right? A recognized department. And somebody said, well, he is the night manager of that doesn't make him an executive. It may make him an administrative employee. He has to manage the department. When you manage a department, there's only one. In my group, I hate to say it, there's only one boss. Is that me? Mm-hmm. Pretty much. And there's only Rabbi. There's only one or two executives at for most companies. Large companies, dozens of executives, but it's a very limited individual. The administrative. This is where all the litigation comes from. This is known as the white collar exemption. This is if you read. You know about assistant managers of Burger King making $3 million on a wage and hour suit, it's always the administrative exemption. They always believe that they've been misclassified. Have the primary duty of performing office or non-manual work directly related to the management of general business and have the primary duty of exercising discretion and independent judgment, right? And then directly related to the management of the business, thank you, Tony, means work directly related to assisting with the running or servicing of a business, such as work and functions, areas, tax, finance, accounting. You can read it. I am running out of time. And there's hundreds, if not thousands, of opinion letters from the DOL, hundreds of pages of regulations defining these exemptions. If you look, and I urge you to Google administrative exemption misclassified, you'll see thousands, if not tens of thousands, of hits in law firms, you'll see there's a lot of assistant store managers and night managers. The fact that somebody can decide whether to throw 30 burgers on the grill for the dinner rush as opposed to 35 doesn't make him an administrative employee, right? He has to use independent discretion and control, judgment, right? And we have the administrative professional, learned, right? If you could go on, learned professionals. Professional exceptions, I'm sorry. Keep going, learned professional, before that. Yeah, keep going, back. Professional, yes. There's learned professionals and creative. First of all, we'll speak about the learned professionals, right? Advanced knowledge. Basically, what I tell individuals, accountant, attorney, engineer, advanced field of study. Tony's giving me the 15-minute warning, right? No, it's fine, you're doing your job. Learned professionals. The fact that, however, you're an attorney and you're unemployed and you're driving a bus, that doesn't make you a learned professional. It can make you lucky or unlucky, depending on how one views the practice of law. It doesn't make you a learned professional. You're, right, you've gone through a period of science of learning, prolonged course of specialized intellectual instruction, and you're practicing that field of study. Creative professional, it's funny, right? There are artists now could be creative professionals. A pastry chef is a creative professional. I don't believe a sous chef is, but an executive chef can be. So, you know, all these shows, if you watch TV, Cake Boss, which I've never seen, more so because I have no desire to see reality TV. But this, you know, people who spend hours and hours building these 8-foot cakes, that would be a creative professional. highly compensated employees, right? $100,000. Obama's regulations would have earned them made it 134. Basically, if somebody earns $100,000, does not include, interestingly, construction employees, because they make, you know, the joke is my attorney doesn't charge as much as my plumber. So for non-construction employees, it's a short test. Computer employees. So we've talked about the administrative, the professional, and the executive exemptions. There you can be paid on a salary. You have to make sure you satisfy the salary basis for the state and the federal, right? You can't dock them, right? Except in very limited areas. First day of first week of employment, last week of employment, Family Medical Leave Act, jury duty, disciplinary notice, which I would never do for extreme safety health violation. So, and I have a memo on that. So they get paid a salary for regardless of how many hours worked. They fall in for one of those exemptions. The salary basis covers both the state and the federal. The state concerns administrative and executive. I don't believe it concerns professional. And then there are a couple other exemptions. Computer employee exemption. You can actually pay an employee on an hourly basis. There's outside sales, very limited. Commission outside, commission salespersons, inside sales, right? Outside sales is actually exempt from the minimum wage and overtime. Minimum wage exemption is extremely rare. Outside sales truly means outside sales. I've done numerous cases, one recently for a kosher company. He was an outside salesperson. A home office is not considered outside sales. A home office is considered just an add-on for the corporate office. So if you work in your outside sales office as your home office, that's not outside sales. If you could go on, please. Ministerial exemption, we discussed that, right? I want you to know it does cover, it would cover Rabbi Kramer, Rabbi Kamensky, other place, and obviously other ministers, people who act close to the minister. It will not cover your maintenance staff. It will not cover your, the cases I had for the yeshiva, one was a maintenance staff, the other one was kitchen staff, one was everybody. It will not cover them, nor should it, right? As much as we like to, they're not ministers. I tell clients, if you want to change the law, that's great, change it. But right now, it's a pretty, it's actually broader now than it was 2 years ago, because 2 years ago there was a debate whether you actually had to be the minister. And the Supreme Court ruled if you're acting in lieu of or close to or related to the minister, and the minister, of course, is advancing church teachings, spreading the faith, and et cetera. Loss of exempt status, right here. Absences of less than 1 day. Personal docking, 1 day. Absence goes, right? So you can actually hear the reasons why. Determining, hold on, compensatory time off. Compensatory time off. It's not permitted for non-exempt employees. Because why? Each work week stands alone. So if you have to get paid overtime for any 7 day period, if you work more than 40 hours, somebody works 50 hours in February, and each work week stands alone, how are you going to reward them in August? Now, two caveats to that. People say, well, my wife or husband works for the government and they're allowed compensatory time. Of course, the government never actually passes laws that they have to follow. They can do federal, state, and municipal employees or any employee of a subdivision thereof is exempt, can receive comp time. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is very simple, is because municipalities, federal and state, the federal government, state governments pass budgets a year in advance. So if there's a disaster, theoretically, well, federal government can print money and one state can print money, but most states and all municipalities have to have a balanced budget. So where are they going to get the money? If there's a disaster, if they have overtime, they can't pay it. So they'll say, I'm going to give you comp time. So compensatory time is permitted in the government sector. The other thing that's interesting is if you're exempt, doesn't matter how many hours you worked, so you can receive comp time, right? So you can say, look, and it's very common with accounting firms, right? They have young kids come out, they're 23, they're going to work at these big firms, and for the months of January, February, March, and April, 4 months of the year, January, March, 3.5 months, they're literally going to work 75, 80 hours a week. So what happens is, and they're doing well, but so they'll say, we'll give you the rest of the year, we'll, you can take this time off. So why are they permitted to do comp time? Because they're exempt, and theoretically it doesn't matter how many hours a week you work. So you could say you're going to work 100 hours this week, 100 hours through April 15th. And then in the summer when it's slow, Joe, you can work 30 hours. So compensatory time is permitted in the in exempt status, not because it's codified in law, but the whole basis of how you compensate exempt employees. New York's spread of hours, New York's employees who are paid, who work more than 10 hours a day, correction, New York employees who start time and end time is more than 10 hours apart and who are lowly paid or at the minimum wage are entitled to an additional hour of pay. It is not very well known. We're going to end on this. It's called the spread of hours. And the spread of hours doesn't mean you have to work 10 hours. It means you could work, let's assume you work from 8:58 a.m. in the morning till 9:02. And then you work from 6:58 to 7:02. That's 4 hours in the morning, 4 hours in the afternoon. You worked 8 minutes. You're being paid minimum wage, which is $11. What do you get paid? You get paid the 8 minutes at the $11 for the hour. So what would, let's say it's 10, let's say a dollar. And then you have to be paid an hour of additional rate of pay. Yes, and an hour of the additional rate of pay at the minimum rate, which would be $11. It's called the spread of hours. You don't have to work it. It's the start time and the end time. And we've done numerous spread case. I've done numerous spread cases. I did a case where somebody was completely compliant, used an out-of-state firm, and actually sued the firm for malpractice because it was in Brooklyn. And he says, we're completely compliant. Hundreds of employees. I don't know what they're looking for. I look at the records. I'm like, you're paying the spread? Like, no, it was about $175,000 he paid. They wanted about $250,000. The problem with that employer is his records were so good because he was in such good compliance that all he had, my colleague's face is dropping. All they had to do was, the DOL, all they had to do was push a button. He was so MS. He said, I'm 100% in compliance. I'm like, you're not paying the spread. Like, what the hell is the spread? I'm like, well, let me ruin your day. So there's the spread of hours. The Wage Theft Prevention Act is the next section, right? Tony, if you could just show this section. And then there's, goes through that. Hold on, just go back. You really want to read that? And so if there's any questions, so this has been a very fast, and I want to thank Tony for preparing the materials. I did not know until I started that I gave her like 80 pages. I'm like, just PDF this out and they'll look at the PDFs. And I understood she had to make slides and a Herculean effort due to my lack of computer knowledge in less than a week. So I want to thank her. This is a very long program, but Shai put me on a leash and he said less than an hour. And if you guys like it, maybe next time I'll have a little bit more time. If you have questions about the materials are just a guide. And if I can't answer them, feel free to give me a call. I work until about 9 o'clock each night, except Friday night. I'm here on Sundays, or email me. Now, if there's any questions, I may answer them for the next 5 minutes or as long as how people want.
Okay, John, thank you so much. That was really wonderful. We do have a bunch of questions that people asked, and we'll see how many of them we can get to. I have an emailed question that a person asked. Someone starts a business, a corporation, and they're the only employee. And there's not enough income or profit to take payroll, which meets the minimum wage and salary regulations. Yet they want to take at least some salary. Is there a way around the regulation in these types of cases?
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about that. First of all, that's a very good question. And whoever asked that deserves credit, because if more people asked that, I'd be out of a job. That being said, the DOL isn't worried. It's worried about employees. If you have an ownership, I want to say one thing though. That people who are sole employees of a company, and they're like, well, there's an exemption for workers' compensation coverage, and like my broker told me or my accountant told me, you have to go to the New York State Workers' Compensation Statute or the relevant states. Most of them allow closely held companies. I believe in New York State, LLCs up to 4 members are exempt from coverage. If you don't fill out the form, it's $2,000 every 10-day fine. But so that individual, make sure he or she's filling out the form. But if you're a shareholder in the company, I wouldn't worry about it. I'd be more worried about making sure you file for the workers' comp exemption as an owner. But okay. That person is a very good question. Don't worry about it.
Next question. There have been a bunch of questions asked about paying biweekly or monthly instead of weekly. Is that an issue?
Yeah, that's unlawful, and I'm involved in a case right now. The problem is I'm involved in a case with a yeshiva, and in the yeshiva, the yeshiva paid by monthly. Each work week stands alone. And the yeshiva has paid me, and by the way, I charge, as Rabbi Kramer can tell. I mean, my sons go there, so he wins the lottery. But the yeshiva's probably paid me about approximately $250,000-$300,000, because they paid monthly. How do you show that? Each work week stands alone. So we had a show, and the ask was $6 million to settle the case. $6 million to settle the case. And we had to retain experts, and we had to create a computer program to show that everyone was probably paid most of what they wanted. Even in the end, we still settled for mid-six figures.
So John, are you saying that it's permitted, but it's hard to prove?
No, it's not permitted. No, it's not permitted, and it's suicide. Because what's going to happen is you can't show the overtime. Each work week stands alone. So if somebody works Monday through Sunday, okay, they're off on Shabbos, or maybe not if you have a kitchen running, who knows. And then you show a month, and it's 30 days, but the month is Tuesday through the month starts on a Tuesday and ends on a Wednesday or ends on a – how are you going to show the overtime? It's going to be what's going to happen is a plaintiff's attorney will see that and will never figure it out, and it will never be done correctly. Someone who's paying on a monthly basis – and by the way, every other week is fine, even though I said that's honored in the breach, provided you show the 2 weeks, right, the first 40-hour week period and the second. If somebody, however, is paying twice a month, the question is – again, what happens to the other 4 weeks? Twice a month is 24 pay periods. Even if that pay period doesn't, no, it's 52 weeks in a year. So what happens is those pay periods won't be equal. Those pay periods will actually be, right, there's 4.3 weeks in a month. So when you say I'm paying biweekly, I'm curious, are you saying every other week? That's against the law for most people, and right? In New York State, it's every week. But let's assume you're doing it. You have to do it correctly. You have to show the 40 hours a week. You have to show the work week. That I can stomach, theoretically, even though I believe it's a violation of the Wage Theft Prevention Act. But that's not the question I believe you're asking. Monthly is a disaster. Who's ever doing that, please call me when the Chas V'Shalom, but that is a recipe for disaster. And when somebody says they're paying bi-monthly, I assume it's twice a month, there is no way to tie in the overtime. Overtime is over 40 hours a week in any 7-day period. A month is 28 days, 30 days, 31 days. How are you tying in the overtime? I have a client. It's just, I want to say one thing. I have a client that's a visiting nurse association, the visiting nurse, but they sometimes get overtime late. And so they pay on a weekly basis, but you may submit submit it late. And they have their payroll, they have computers, they have apps. And on their paychecks, they show you for each pay period, and they have the ability, they have 3,000 employees, to go back and say, okay, you submitted overtime for a pay period a month ago because you were late, because again, they provide throughout the right pay there. We're going to pay you overtime. But there have significant computer programmers who've created the software. You have to tie in the overtime. You're not doing it. There's no way that's being done. That is a recipe.
Let me ask a different question. Are there guidelines for training periods for new employees?
Okay, training, it's interesting. I had a section on training, and I took it out. Training is permissible. However, don't do it. It has to be a transferable skill. You can't guarantee them employment, them being the trainee. You have to, a transferable skill. It must have an educational component. Pay the minimum wage. I mean, pay the employees minimum wage. Interns, if you can just Google interns unlawful wage and hour suits, you'll get thousands of hits. So a true training program, if you teach a transferable skill, unfortunately, most skills aren't transferable. If you're being trained, you should be paid. Doesn't mean you have to get paid at your regular rate of pay. You can pay them at the minimum rate. There is one, sometimes training doesn't have to be paid. I'm general counsel to an employer association that has a union contract. That there's a trade school. They go to apprentices go to school at night. They receive an education worth tens of thousands of dollars, and they learn a trade, whether steam fitter, sprinkler fitter, or plumber. They're not getting paid for that, but they're coming at night. They're learning a skill. But if you're on the employee's premises, working side by side with other employees, working during the day.
Going back to the other discussion, going back to the other discussion about the monthly or biweekly, people are pressing on this. If they have punch clocks and they have a payroll company that makes it very, very clear for each week broken down how much was regular pay, regular time, and overtime, is that a problem?
Okay, okay. New York State, first of all, there are a bunch of payroll communities. There are good ones and bad ones, and I'm not going to name the bad ones, but I cannot tell you. There's only about two, three, or four of them, and I've done work for almost all of them in the Orthodox community who will do exactly what the client is asked and will never say this is wrong. And offline, I will say which ones I think are good, and I don't have an ownership interest in any of them. That's number one. And you can hear the diction in my voice. I continually get cases with this yeshiva. They said, can we go after our payroll company? I'm like, that's your business, not mine. That's number two. Number three, the law in New York State says you have to get, has to be paid on a weekly basis unless there's an exemption. Let's forget about that nonsense. I refuse to believe the tie-in is done correctly.
Okay, if you're saying that the law of New York State is that you must pay weekly, then it's not a discussion.
Unless you get an exemption, that's the law.
Whereas
I think the DOL would not fine or fine maybe $1,000 if somebody got paid every other week, I can imagine what the fine would be once a month. I mean, the people who are being paid once a month, and not that I'm a great liberal, because I'm not. I'm a Republican, right? Forgive me for saying that to 250 people. But the people who the DOL is protecting is not the people wearing a Brooks Brothers tie. And when the employee comes and says, I get paid once a month, they're going to be livid. And they're going to seek to find that employee any which way they can. What you're doing is you're holding the money on a float and paying the employee. I would say even better, are you paying at the beginning of the month? Right, you're recalculating everything. Why aren't you paying them at the beginning of the month? No, you're paying them at the end of the month. I've done 1,000 of these investigations. You're floating. The employer is floating his business on the lapse in the payroll. And it's being done incorrectly. I refuse to believe it's done correctly. You could send me a payroll and I'll point it out. But
okay.
The float is what's going to.
Question: how about an exemption for a student employed at a school? Are they exempt from state minimum wage? Who's called the student?
It's interesting. As you know, I represent a lot of schools and non-Jewish schools. The only time I was on the cover of the New York Times was for an educational school establishment. It's always nice being on the cover of the Times front page. That being said, it's interesting. So there are exemptions. For instance, student works for you at camp. Provided the camp, even something as that, provided the camp, and what's defined as a camp? A camp is an institution that draws most of its income during the summer months, with the summer months actually defined by that, by the regulations. They don't have to be paid minimum wage and overtime. But somebody working for a school, right, it's got to be paid minimum wage. I see no exemption. I would have to check that. So for the first time, and we're an hour and 5 minutes, I would want to check that, confirm that. Somebody wants to call me and discuss it offline, but I know there's no I cannot, doing this 27 years, with the gray hair, I do not see a reason why an individual would be a student. I was a student and I worked. As I said, didn't make me an independent contractor, didn't make me anything except poor. So I do not see why, under the statutes, which I'm pretty well familiar with, someone would be exempt. By the way, there's work study, right? But that is, are we talking in New York State. However, those are for colleges and trade schools. Are we talking about, and by the way, those programs are registered with the New York State Department of Education. Are we talking about colleges and proprietary educational institutions? Or
yes.
Are we talking about?
Yes, college.
We are?
And
do they receive?
Both high school.
Do they receive credit?
Yes.
If they receive credit.
Many base medrash programs are accredited.
Forgive me, I I was thinking, and I just want to say, when I think of students, I was thinking of my child going to Rambam or as you know, South Shore. But if there are strict regulations, which are outside the courts of, because that's another hour, but if somebody is in an upper level, base midrash, college, proprietary educational institution, and is receiving credit or work study, then they don't have to get paid. When I thought of, forgive me, I'm projecting me being an 18-year-old kid 35 years ago working all these jobs. So the answer to that person, but it's not just, oh, you're exempt because you're getting credit. I mean, there's a little bit more, there's some hoops to go through. But the answer to your question is yes. In a high school setting, I would say the answer is no.
Okay. One more question and we'll close it up. Let's say someone's salaried, but they're a janitor. So even though they're salaried, they're supposed to get overtime. Let's say they did 7 hours overtime in a week. How do you determine the overtime rate?
Well, it's called the regular rate. And what happens is this, it's, you do the math. So for, let's say, so the guy works, you pay him 1,000. So you divide, if he works 50 hours that week, it would be 15 to 1,000. His hourly rate would be $20 for all straight time hours worked. And he would have a halftime rate for $10. So he'd be entitled to 10 hours at $10 an hour, the halftime. So he'd get $1,100. Of course, look what happens. The more hours you work him, the denominator keeps increasing, that hourly rate decreases. So if he works 60 hours, he would go 60 into 1,000. It's a written agreement. It's called a salary payment agreement. It covers all straight time hours. So what's 16 to 1,000 quickly, if you could do that on your computer? So 16 to 1,000, let's say $16 and 60 something cents, 16 cents. So what's 16 to 1,000?
Into 1,000.
Need a calculator. Okay, John, we get the picture. Basically, what you're saying is you take their salary, you divide it by the hours a week they're supposed to be working, mm-hmm. and
and that's only for the halftime. However, such an agreement has to be in writing. It's called a salary payment agreement. Nice. I hope this, see, I have no idea if you guys liked it or not. Please email Rabbi Kramer, let me know if you liked it. if you have any questions, I'm going back to my office. And or Shai, I apologize. Shai, thank you. And I'll be back at my office at 5 o'clock. Ladies and gentlemen, it's thank you for your time, and it's been a pleasure.
Okay, John, thank you, everyone.
John or Rabbi Kramer, thank you very much. Thank you for giving the time.
Pleasure.
I plan on sending out the PDF and the PowerPoint and the audio and also all your contact information. So anybody has follow-up questions or anyone wants any more of the memos that you had written, we'll be able to share it with them later. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, and we'll have a good one. Thank you all.
Thank you.